This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 53, and I'm delighted to welcome Cormac Leach, co-founder and director of Liberum Alternative Finance, focused on developing fintech companies, particularly around B2B. Investment bank Liberum have done some $2 billion of capital raising for investment trusts, notably P2P GI, which is now a listed FTSE 250 company, which, to make that explicit, means that one of the largest 250 companies in the UK purely invests in P2P. An interesting stat in itself when you hear how fintech ain't much from the odd naysayer. Cormac is perhaps London's best known and deepest thinker on alternative finance. In LFP 038, Peter Renton and I discussed the highlights of Lendit 2015, Europe's largest P2P conference. We both picked out Cormac's coruscating presentation, a little like the scene in Apocalypse Now where they're on LSD under the bridge while the battle is going on. More prosaically, it fitted a three-hour presentation into about 20 minutes, included everything about P2P, including advice to the Bank of England as to how they should in future use it to control the money supply. Anyway, no LSD this morning, just some strong coffee, too many biscuits, and I'll do my best to hold on to the reins, even if I'm dragged along the ground by the horse. Plenty has been happening in all directions with P2P. I was reminded of what I used to think of as Hegel's dialectic, but Wikipedia tells me it's not Hegel. Hegel's dialectic, or not Hegel's dialectic, being thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Thesis meaning, hey, there's this new thing, P2P in this case. Antithesis, which is perhaps where we are at the moment, is going, no, that's not so good after all. And we're a bit short of the synthesis stage, which is on the one hand and on the other hand, and it's a new balance. So maybe we can get to some synthesis from Cormac. I thought it would be great to hear from someone who, although having an indirect stake in the success of the industry, like us all, is not the CEO of a P2P, and therefore rather more dispassionate. Talking of Lendit and not being stooges of the industry, both Cormac and I moderated risk panels last year for Lendit US and Lendit Europe, respectively. Cormac's moderating included not letting rates set her off the hook with hand-waving about what risk is. Mine included asking leading players to quantify the risk that investors are taking and getting something like a 98% vote from the audience that the P2Ps had failed completely in their replies to quantifying risk. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Cormac, thanks for joining me today.
Hi Mike, good to be on the show. So I'm co-founder and director of Liberum Alternative Finance, focused on developing fintech companies, particularly around peer-to-peer marketplace lending.
Excellent. We were talking, as I always do, to people beforehand, saying it's actually quite nice to find a human being leading, but then you said you're not really a human being because all you ever do is fintech. apart from sailing dogs or something.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm a bit boring, frankly, Mike, but so I probably shouldn't focus too much on the human side of it. But I can talk a bit about a career, how we got interested in fintech, if that's interesting. I started off life as a derivatives trader, actually, structuring interest rate derivatives, swaps, options, and what have you.
Which stage of the market was that?
That was back in like 95 or so.
So that's post-ISDA?
Would have been, yeah.
And for those people who don't know what ISDA is, ISDA, the International Swap Dealers Association, originally when derivatives came along, they were all bilateral, which is a very interesting comparison with P2P, meaning that A did a deal with B with one set of documentation, B did a deal with C with a different set of documentation, etc., etc. ISDA then came along and did this master agreement, which meant that the market had changed. And we're now in the stage where we've got sort of central counterparties. It's a concept we may come on to later. So maybe there's some parallel we can pick up later on that one.
Yeah, interesting. So I was doing derivatives, then moved into McKinsey, was doing strategy consulting, mainly for financial institutions, then had the opportunity to become a banks analyst of all things. So, you know, spent about 10 years, frankly, working at the likes of ABN AMRO, JP Morgan, covering the large big cap banks like HSBC, Standard Chartered, then actually some of the investment banks like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley from JP Morgan. So I have a pretty good idea how the incumbents make money or, you know, basically don't make money, depending on which year you're talking about. And then towards the back end of that, started to become aware of peer-to-peer. And then, frankly, Andrew Haldane of Bank of England wrote a really interesting paper in 2012 that really got me excited, called Towards a Common Financial Language. That was it. Talking about, you know, how peer-to-peer lending was still very small, but, you know, so was the internet back in 95. And look where the internet is today. Exponential growth potential. And that really kind of resonated at Liberum. And we've since then, we've been kind of committing a fair amount of resource into the space. and looking to do interesting things?
Well, I think going back to being a researcher, you'll know that there's sort of whole forests worth of trees are cut down every week to produce research, and most of it's not particularly interesting. But Andy Haldane is the one person who's written papers which certainly have stuck in my mind, which next to none have since about the year 2000. In particular, he wrote an excellent one called The Dog and the Frisbee, which was about how complex systems, i.e. banks, can only be controlled by simple algorithms, and that trying to control complex systems, i.e. banks or financial services as a whole, with complex systems, i.e. infinite amount of regulation, is not going to work. So yes, he's a big favourite of mine, although more recently I was very disappointed to see him pushing this sort of cashless society and all that kind of stuff, but that's a different thing entirely.
Yeah, I would agree, actually. Yeah, there's a slightly big brotherish, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a very Orwellian when everything you do is tracked by the state, you know, at every minute, every one of your expenditures. And also, I'm not entirely sure how it really allows you to have a bank run anymore. If there's no such thing as cash, you can't queue up outside Northern Rock to take your money out.
That's probably right, unless we can have some kind of anonymized blockchain-based cash where literally the authorities can't control it as well as they'd like to.
Yes. Well, given the way that society is going, I'm not sure that they really want to not control anything. But going back to the banking thing, so just as a banking analyst, I mean, going back to your various presentations, your depth of background really shows through in terms of your being informed and having a deeper context to the sort of P2P and fintech as a whole and alternative finance than the sort of fluffy bunnies who turned up yesterday and don't know much about P2P or fintech and learning about it as they go along. I mean, how much can you analyse a bank these days? So let's take, for example, Citigroup or HSBC, vast global organisations, hundreds of thousands of people around the world. How on earth can anybody, whether the researcher or the CEO, know very much at all about that?
That's a very fair point. I mean, they've got a huge balance sheet, which is, you know, even with increased disclosure recently, still very much opaque. So a lot of it has to be taken on trust. And of course, the big problem you have is that you've got a huge agency problem. You've got a CEO sitting there, average tenure, 3 to 5 years. He doesn't really care about the long-term prospects of the business. He really just cares about getting paid a good salary and bonus for the next 3 to 5 years, and then he can sail off into the sunset. And if the bank blows up in year six, that's someone else's problem.
Yes, touch wood, I've got a pod recording next week, which may be following you in terms of being released, with a well-known gentleman, who may name this at the moment, but he wrote a book called Other People's Money. And so the problem with finance is that it's trading other people's money at the moment. And going back to when I started in 85, it wasn't other people's money. It was pretty much, certainly, you know, the sort of stockbroking or merchant banking sectors, one's own money. And people trading with one's own money have a rather different attitude than with someone else's money.
I mean, there is an easy fix to that, by the way. I mean, A, you can allow CEOs to run banks for longer, so keep them in place for 10 years plus, or you back end their comp, right? So you give them a base salary, and their bonuses and variable compensation don't vest for 10 years from when they earn it. And then you do align interest, right?
Yes, I remember seeing that proposal first coming from the Bank of England in the early 90s, and I'm still not holding my breath waiting for it to happen. So moving on to the P2P then, I mean, one of the things that I actually quite liked, and I bumped into in some drinks party earlier the year, was I said, well, you know, you should be on the show sometime because you always got lots to say and all that kind of thing. And at the time, he said, well, you didn't have any particularly sort of fresh insights, which I really quite like, because the conference scene in London is full of people banging on about fintech and talking about the same thing time and time again, but actually with very little fresh to say. And we were just talking before about the trouble with talking about Lending Club. I mean, is there much to say about Lending Club that, you know, hasn't been in the press so far?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Maybe there isn't. But I mean, what we can talk a bit about the bigger picture and, you know, what's the solution? I mean, I actually think that there is a solution. I'm not sure if you want to go into that now.
Well, let's go into it, because I said before, there's this thesis, antithesis and synthesis. The thesis is, this is fantastic, this is great, this is the entire future of finance, banks are going to disappear, blah, blah, blah. The antithesis is collapsing share prices, my God, it's a load of rubbish. Adair Turner saying it's going to be the biggest thing that's going to go wrong since nuclear power stations blowing up, yardy, yardy, yardy. So why don't you try and sort of have a stab at the synthesis, which is on the one hand, on the other hand, and putting them two together?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I mean, if you take a step back, I mean, banks have been doing banking for 500 odd years, and, you know, I haven't gone back to kind of banking scandals of the 1600s, but I'm pretty sure there was probably something analogous to what happened with Renault back in the 1600s we've forgotten about, i.e. banker changes some of the information regarding to some loans. So they've had 500 years to put the checks and balances in and to iron the stuff out. To some extent, fintech companies so far, we've had to rely on the management doing the right thing. And frankly, you know, if you look at the quality of the CEOs of a lot of these platforms, they are very high quality individuals. if that's a, you know, a term I can use, where you can trust them to do the right thing. But inevitably, humans are human, and you can't rely on fintech companies doing the right thing without checks and balances and independent oversight. So, and that's basically what we need. We just need an independent verification process. You know, our starting point should be every CEO of a fintech company is a crook, and we need to put an independent verification system, process, company, whatever you want to call it, in place such that we can make sure everybody's being honest. And once you put that in place, then fintech should flourish. It's as simple as that.
Indeed, I keep missing Jeff Miller, former CEO of GLI Finance, to talk to him about corporate governance. And I think he sits on more boards of P2Ps and alt-fis than anybody in the world.
Busy man, yeah.
A very busy man. And, you know, he's seen a lot from the inside. And corporate governance sounds like a very boring thing to people. It's not hip, it's not hot, it's not sexy or anything like that. But for grown-ups, corporate governance is really important. Otherwise, you've got, as we have at the moment, boards that are comprised of the founders who want the ball to go in one direction and the VCs who are funding it who want the ball to go in the same direction. And they have nobody sitting on there, for example, which you do in building societies or banks, some person with grey hair or no hair who's been around the block, who's a non-executive chairing the risk committee saying, OK, well, I'm glad you say that, Mr. Head of Risk, but do you know what? How do I know your data's right? Or anything like that. Yeah. So there's the corporate governance piece missing. And then I read a good article recently by Kadeem Schuber of the FT. He's a very young journalist I had the pleasure of meeting recently, but he's really making waves in terms of his coverage. And he was talking about some of the challenges around securitization and the lack of verification of data and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, some of the things that are happening, certainly in the States, around securitization of P2P assets, he was comparing, I think quite rightly, with what happened around all the sort of home loan crisis some time ago. So to a certain extent, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
There is one kind of key distinction, though. I mean, if you look at the guys at Bear Stearns, Deutsche Bank, wherever, where they were doing that securitization back in 2007, the fundamental difference was that the guy doing that was really focused on his year-end bonus. So he would shovel, you know, manure out the door as quickly as he could such that he could get his bonus at the end of the year. If you contrast that with peer-to-peer platforms, you've got the CEO actually cares about the long-term value of that particular platform. So he's less likely to put low-quality stuff out the door. So the originate-distribute model is, you know, that analogy is somewhat correct, but it's not completely fair, actually.
No, absolutely. That's certainly true. I mean, but going back to, you know, do you trust CEOs or not trust CEOs, then I agree with your answer, which is that it can't be a question of whether you trust them or don't. I mean, you know, presumably one needs to trust them. But as the saying goes, trust in Allah, but tie up your camel.
Or as Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. So I think that was when he was talking about the Russians, so which basically meant pretend that you trust them at the time, but check every single thing they say.
Oh, right. Especially around Iran-Contra, presumably. And one of the developments we've seen recently is a firm called Global Debt Registry.
That's right.
What do you make of these guys?
Well, I've kind of met these guys a couple of times. I mean, they saw my presentation at Lendit last year and they reached out. And yeah, I mean, I've been kind of excited about them and telling various people about them. There's a good guy there called Charlie Moore who's been kind of actively getting the word out about the need for that. But frankly, I'm not sure they're exactly in the sweet spot of what's needed.
And for listeners who haven't heard of Global Debt Registry, briefly, what are they? What do they do?
Well, I mean, I think it's slightly dynamic what they're doing. But as I understand it, they keep an independent record of all the loans which have been originated by various platforms. And they store all the metadata. And then they verify who owns which loan part over time. So it becomes almost like a land registry, if you like, in the UK for credit assets. What they do not do is verify the cash flows for particular loans over the life of that particular loan, which I think is sorely needed. I think we need someone when Lending Club, you know, facilitate a loan to be created where one lender is lending to a particular borrower. They actually need to verify that the cash has left the lender's account, you know, and then has gone into the account of the borrower, less any fees, and actually just verify that the loan contract that has been created by Lending Club is consistent with those verified bank cash flows. And then you're actually, you no longer have to rely to any extent on the peer-to-peer platform being honest, effectively.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here, I mean, let's move on from Global Debt Registry, which is just one firm, to the issue. What we're talking about here is really, what is the P2P doing? If they're originating and distributing, then it's quite useful having a central clearinghouse, shall we say, just for the sake of argument.
Right.
Even at a data level, a central clearinghouse of data.
Exactly.
Like the analogy I was making before with the derivative market that sees all the flows going in and out.
Although that is a slightly different concept, right? Because the clearinghouse is absorbing all the credit risk of the different counterparties, whereas this would just be maintaining a highly trusted information database, right?
Yes, I was using it loosely, and I was using it in a sort of modern way, which is that the modern thing is information, which is that if they're tracking the information, and you know all these terrible problems around validating, you know, is there such a person called Cormac Leach in the first place? Does he actually live there?
Does he exist?
Yeah, exactly. We know he isn't a good credit, but maybe some platform thinks you're a good credit, you know, yada, yada, yada. And it'll be interesting to see whether the platforms themselves would like that kind of thing, or whether they would resist it.
Well, it's interesting. Giles Andrews, the co-founder and currently chairman of Zopa, said he would actively support it. He actually thinks that it would be a step in the right direction. And I think it would be tremendously positive, counterintuitively perhaps, for the platforms if they embraced this idea, because I think it would make the sector hugely more investable. It would just take the whole fraud question off the table. You would silence all those people running around saying, oh, look what happened at LendingClub, isn't this sector, you know, no longer viable? You just take that issue off the table.
So in this model then, the platforms source lenders. They find people who want to give money and get a return. And on the other hand, they source borrowers. They find people who want to borrow with the right sort of credit quality, yada, yada, yada. And the kind of reconciliation bit in the middle is then done by a third party. And I can see that's quite strong. I mean, going back to the data and mentioning Kadeem, he wrote some interesting pieces on RateSetter earlier in the year about the fact that, okay, look, the portfolio's out there, but actually if you go through it in detail, there's errors in the data.
Well, I mean, you know, anything created by humans has flaws in it, right? You know,
especially humans. Humans are created by humans, and they're definitely flawed.
humans get a lot of good stuff done too, though. But I mean, it's kind of, is it like the noise? You know, there's noise in any signal, right? So it's a question of just filtering out the noise. But to be clear, I mean, this kind of parallel data verification sounds cumbersome, but actually in today's, you know, high-tech world, you could actually automate this and make it super efficient so that it wouldn't really be a drag at all, and it wouldn't really push up the operating expenses of the whole system.
I agree, and I was talking off the record to the FCA recently around this whole problem of know your client and all this kind of stuff, where I think it's just fundamentally, outrageously wrong that the state has put a responsibility on directors of firms to do KYC with 100.00%, because in the real world, nothing gets done that, you know? And you're doing the KYC, you may have a very good process. Oh, but you know what? 10 years later, you happen to lend to somebody who, under a new definition, is a terrorist, they'll lock you up and throw away the key. And what I was saying to them on similar lines, which is that, okay, it's okay if the state wants to do that and question its definition in some cases, but the state can then, actually, for the sake of argument, provide an API, which is I send Cormac Leach, you know, Liberum Capital, blah, 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 and it pings me back your, I don't know, national insurance number or something. It said, yes, this is a genuine person, and he's okay as far as we're concerned.
Right.
You know, and don't tell me that GCHQ and a whole bunch of other folks couldn't do that. And then again, you're taking the identity thing back away from individuals who can't do it properly.
Yeah, I guess the downside of that is that it back to your Orwell comment,
yes,
you know, it does become a bit Big Brother-esque, doesn't it?
Well, it is Big Brother-esque at the moment, in that there's this Thomson Reuters database, whose name has temporarily escaped me, and that all the banks are using and now the state is using, which is miscategorising a whole bunch of actually very respectable folks, one of whom was a donor to the Tory party, as terrorists and a whole bunch of stuff like that. So actually it exists on the sly at the moment. But the point here, I think, is an interesting point, which is that in terms of thesis, antithesis and synthesis, one of the things that you're pointing out, and I'm entirely with you, which is that, okay, we know what P2P is now, but what would a radical innovation be? What would a radical change be? So it looks somewhat different in a year or two's time. And what we're saying, actually, we can take some elements out of it, which aren't the particularly added value ones, and actually you'd put those elements in a firm who's focusing specifically on data quality, shall we say, and data integrity in a central repository like the DVLA, which is the one that keeps track of the driver's licenses in the UK, or like the Land Registry, which in principle tracks the land, but actually turns out not to track very much land at all in the UK. Okay, so that's one way of slicing it to the moment. And then just in terms of some of the noise in the sector, I mean, people with books to sell, like Adair Turner, who was the ex-chairman of the FSA, came out recently and said, oh, it's all been a disaster and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, again, just in terms of watching the industry from the sidelines, I thought it was quite fascinating, because on the one hand, you had Christian from Lendinvest coming out with a very Australian, why would you trust a bloke who was asleep at the wheel when the last car crash happened? And on the other hand, you had Simeon Desai, CEO of Funding Circle, now CBE, saying, well, I think Adair Turner's got some very good points which we need to take on board. So you've got a whole spectrum between the sort of the rebels and the prefects. What did you make about all that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I have huge respect for Adair Turner.
So you're going for an OBE and a CBE as well?
Frankly, anybody that kind of gets funded by George Soros to do macroeconomics, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, at least temporarily. He's written a brilliant book called Between Debt and the Devil. I think he's actually a very creative thinker. When I spoke to the FT journalists that were speaking to him about his comments about peer-to-peer, apparently it was actually an offhand comment made at the end of an interview on a completely different topic.
So, that's the context I hadn't heard.
Yeah, interestingly, he has signed up to be a keynote speaker at Lendit this year. So it'll be interesting to see if he's actually going to tell us, you know, at that conference that we're all a bunch of jokers and the whole thing's going to end in tears. I suspect he's going to be slightly more sanguine. His basic idea was, you know, actually peer-to-peer credit quality is not very good. I mean, I think the evidence doesn't quite bear that out for the leading platforms. If you look at how they actually do it, I think, you know, if you look at Zopa, for example, the credit quality has consistently been much better than the leading banks in the UK. If you actually look at the process they follow, for example, before you can borrow from Zopa, they actually ring up the main switchboard where you work and ask to be put through to you to see, do you actually exist and have a job there? Whereas the banks don't do that. So, you know, they actually, if you look at the processes, they're at least as impressive as what the banks do. The other thing is that if you look at who designed the credit processes, first of all, they were designed very recently using best practices. And, you know, it's mission critical for a CEO is highly incentivized to make sure the credit quality is good compared to, you know, the chief credit guy at Lloyd's or Barclays probably is getting paid not very much, doesn't really expect to get paid a lot more if he does a good job than if he does a bad job, probably has a lifetime pension. He's not really incentivized to do a good job credit underwriting. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that if you actually look at the data, so if you compare the credit quality of the big banks versus peer-to-peer currently, the peer-to-peer platforms are underwriting as well or better than the banks in the current environment. As a banks analyst, I can tell you, when you look at different originators at different points in time, if originator one is better than originator two at one point in time, he's very likely to stay better through the cycle. And, you know, on that basis, I think, you know, you can very plausibly argue we can look at 20 years, 30 years of bank data and actually use that to inform how peer-to-peer will behave through the cycle. And it does not bear out the Adair Turner's warning that this is going to end in tears. So I actually think the more you research peer-to-peer, the more you realize it's actually much less risky than equities. And if you can get over the fraud risk, which we have talked about, then it's a great asset class to invest in.
Yes, I agree with all that. And I hadn't heard the point about it was a throwaway remark. I mean, as you say, he's a deep thinker. And as I mentioned before, I was the only one I've heard say this. But a while ago, he was talking about socially useless trading, a concept that, which the French quite love because they want a turnover tax, which may or may not be a good thing.
I think it'd be a good thing.
Just slow down the financialization of the whole economy, where the tail ends up wagging the dog. But I went much further and I thought, socially useless trading, that's interesting. So you also got socially useless accounting, you've got socially useless regulation, you've got socially useless government, you've got socially useless state. There's a whole bunches of the whole economy these days, we actually don't really do anything for society as a whole. But nobody actually took it that far. It was really just aimed at sort of trading in the pre-Volcker times when they were going to split off trading, which is a bad thing from all the other risky sort of stuff. So moving on then, in terms of some of the critiques, Deloitte recently in the UK came out and said, it's all terrible, which at least was interesting that someone says it's all terrible for a change, because normally people say it's all wonderful. But then I think actually maybe it was Jeff I saw tweeting about the fact that's interesting, because obviously Deloitte Europe or UK doesn't speak to Deloitte America, because Deloitte America had come out with a research report saying, it's all wonderful.
Yeah. I saw the report and, you know, various people were asking me what I think. And frankly, I didn't have time to read it because it's actually quite a large document. It took me about 3 or 4 days to find the time to actually kind of read the entire thing. Not continuously 4 days, but, you know, over 4 days.
You're a very slow reader.
But I have to say, it was quite a thorough piece of work. And it did make me think, because they've done something that I'd never seen done before. The thing that we've been banging on about, you know, as fans of peer-to-peer is that it's fundamentally much more efficient than banking. The interesting thing that Neil Tomlinson, the author of the Deloitte piece, did was he added the funding costs into the comparison. So basically what he's done is he's looking at the total cost to actually make a loan, including the funding cost for a bank versus peer-to-peer lending. And then what he does is he says, actually, guess what? Banks have a much lower cost of capital because they have the very cheap deposit base. And that actually makes them, on his analysis, slightly more efficient than peer-to-peer. You know, so he's basically got funding costs for a bank of 200 basis points, funding costs for peer-to-peer 500 basis points. And, you know, when you add that into the mix, actually banks do look better on his analysis. I mean, there's some other flaws in it, but that's the big kind of new idea Deloitte has introduced. The flaw in that argument, which is kind of baked into a very large document, so, you know, it kind of it's easy to overlook it, is that the assumption fundamentally is that 500 basis points is fair market value for lending on peer-to-peer. Now, I would argue that the fair price that lenders should be getting on peer-to-peer platforms, you know, lending to prime consumers in the UK, for example, is much closer to 3.5%, which is basically what you could achieve if you securitize the thing and sold it to professional asset-backed traders and, you know, guys holding the equity. Therefore, you basically get in a super normal 150 basis points investing in peer-to-peer. And that's why the sector has grown, you know, 100, 150% per annum year on year, because investors are attracted to that above market arbitrage investment opportunity. So that's kind of the flow on the Deloitte thing. And when you factor that in, the whole Deloitte argument kind of unravels. So a question for you is, do you think at some point in the future, we could get the Deloitte chap in here and we could have a kind of a debate, you know, and kind of go through the pros and cons of the structural underpinnings of peer-to-peer versus banking?
Well, to take you a step back from that question, I think that it's a bit like the Adair Turner. You know, in a world where you've got 10 billion tweets a day and a million sort of web articles and 1,000 million emails, it's always the short eye-catching thing that people focus on. But actually, if you look behind that, as you say, there's quite a lot of work in there, and then there's the model in the middle. And actually, I'd come across exactly the same chart, and I'll give you my response to that in a minute. It's like the Adair Turner, it says lots of good things, and lots of, well, I'm not so sure about that, and things we might disagree
with. The problem is people listen to Deloitte, and then, you know, if you come out with a 50-page document...
Yes, well, it's interesting. Well, I mean, the thing that pissed me off as a taxpayer was that Ernst & Young was paid by the government an absolute fortune on fintech as a whole to decide that the government was wonderful, the Treasury was wonderful, and that the UK is the best place in the world. On the previous one with John Volomir from R5FX, we're talking about some very interesting innovations that the Indian Stock Exchange is doing, for example. You know, and this kind of, I think it's a somewhat sort of racist, old-fashioned imperialist thing that sort of Britain is the best. Well, we've got some good ideas, but we're actually not the best. There's lots of clever people around the world. But just specifically on this model that they were coming up with, you're a researcher, so you're more sympathetic with models. I sort of more of a pragmatist coming back from sort of fund management and being a risk person in the background, which is that all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I think the basic idea is correct. The basic idea, which is that a bank can leverage itself, and therefore, if you're a simple, clean, efficient bank, you've got great advantage. So actually, I'm a big fan of Aldermore, for example, you know, one of the new challenger banks. Or if you're a building society like Nationwide, it's a very simple bank, then I think the gearing all works out. I think where it starts to fall apart is that you can't consider something like Citigroup or HSBC as a bank just doing lending and borrowing. They're doing a million billion things.
The problem with bankers is that a lot of them are too bright to stay there and stick to the knitting. So they've got to add in all the bells and whistles and the things that are going to justify huge bonuses in particular years. And then, you know, so you end up with huge agency problems effectively.
Exactly. We spoke before about some of the innovations around the, you know, the global debt registry and around tracking data independently. What other interesting things do you see coming up over the horizon as opposed to, on the one hand, this is wonderful, or on the other hand, it's terrible, or maybe it's half and half?
In terms of innovations coming...
And to P2P, what excitement's out there? Or is it just kind of, oh, in the UK, more will fall away, and the, you know, the Zopas, rate setters, funding circles will get a bigger market share, and we'll all fall asleep quietly on the side?
So, I mean, to be clear, I think if we add in a little bit of infrastructure around data verification, then the sector will absolutely thrive. And I agree, Larry Summers, you know, we're heading for 30-40% of consumer lending will be through peer-to-peer, and potentially 70% plus of SME lending in the same way. I think, you know, by nature, kind of I'm interested in disruption and kind of constantly looking to disrupt everything, including our own business here at Liberum. And kind of the next opportunity I'm kind of aware of is the opportunity to disrupt the investment trust space. So we've got a bunch of investment trusts investing in peer-to-peer. The next generation of enabling people to invest in this new asset class, in my view, is a peer-to-peer aggregator type solution. And we're actually working on one called LendingWell, but there are others like InvestUp, Bond Mason are doing something similar. But effectively, it's a huge financial plumbing job where, keep thinking of like kind of the stylized investor, wealthy dentist in Devon, doesn't know anything about peer-to-peer, really likes the idea of getting a 6% low risk return. You basically give him a place he can go to, put his money in, 5 to 10 mouse clicks, he's put his money to work in a very safe, low risk way. He sleeps well at night and it takes a very small amount of his time. And you critically, you charge him a very thin layer of fees. So you charge him, let's say, 50 basis points per annum. Contrast that with the 3 or 4% that many funds charge you, and it's not hard to see why you get much more return for much less risk as the end investor. So it's effectively like a robo-advisor for this asset class. I think that's a big disruption that we're going to see. And the question is who dominates, because you should expect a natural monopoly. We've got our horse in the race, but as I mentioned, there are some others as well. But LendingWell.com is the one that we're pushing hard to kind of be the category winner there. We're allocating quite a bit of resource to that currently.
A few podcasts ago, I spoke to Jake Winwell-Povey, the CEO of Goji, who were looking at the IFISA and all that kind of stuff, and it was when it was still a little bit unclear and the FCA hadn't approved people and yada, yada, yada. I've slightly lost track of the story. So where are we at the moment on the IFISA and being able to diversify the funds there? Because that's a good way for the general retail public to start getting involved. And I can see that, you know, aggregators are a good solution to that. I mean, even for, quotes, someone like me, unquotes, I don't really have the time to mess around. I'd much rather go and do a few clicks, done, you know, move on, job done.
And you're hugely at the more sophisticated end of things, so imagine, you know, the...
It's all relative, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, imagine how uninformed the rest of them are, right?
Exactly, blimey.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Jake and Goji have done actually a very good job lobbying, as I understand it, to get the slight change in legislation so that aggregators can actually provide innovative ISAs. Yeah, so my understanding is that currently, you know, the door is open for peer-to-peer aggregators to provide a innovative ISA through which you can invest into lots of individual peer-to-peer platforms, which, as you say, is a big, you know, win for the average investor.
Absolutely, I agree. And what about things like current accounts and P2Ps and other kind of radical ones? Let's finish on that.
So going back to the Deloitte thing, I mean, part of their fundamental thesis is that banks have a huge access to very, very cheap money because everyone keeps a bunch of cash sitting there earning nothing that they can use to pay bills. So the obvious next step or the next frontier for peer-to-peer, once it gets to scale and is sufficiently accepted, is to actually offer people a payment card. And probably, you know, it's going to be linked to your iPhone. Basically, you put cash in there, can be your salary going in there, and you can use that account to pay all your bills, literally, you know, manage all your cash. But while your money is sitting there, you're getting a very attractive rate of interest. And then if you do go into deficit at some point in the month, then you can borrow from the crowd at a very attractive rate of interest. So it becomes a dynamic peer-to-peer account. The challenge with that is that you need maturity transformation. So you have inevitable liquidity risks with that. But there's a very easy fix. You can basically get the Bank of England to step in and basically agree to backstop the system on the one day out of 1,000 that I actually need to. And if you actually think about it from a systemic risk point of view, it is entirely in the interests of the Bank of England and the government to do that, because on that one day in 1,000, I can guarantee you that GDP is heading down the pan and they absolutely need to reassure people. So it would be a huge win-win for them to put that kind of backstop in place that would enable peer-to-peer to become basically a current account.
It's interesting. Well, I think there's a couple of things spring to mind. I mean, the first is I love your very much sort of researcher's hat phrase of there's one easy solution, because it reminds me of all the days when the research department always had one easy solution, but other departments like corporate finance had quite a hard job actually ever implementing things and getting them to happen. But you are right, there's always some straightforward solution. The other one, which is that I had James Sherwin Smith of Growth Street on the podcast a few episodes ago, and they're providing a business overdraft on P2P.
Interesting.
Which is a parallel model what we're talking about. So from all these sort of interesting explosions around the bridge in our apocalypse now on P2P, moving on to Liberum. So where are you? Where are you guys going? So, you know, generally, what do you do? What's the strength around here?
Yeah, so Liberum's got, you know, about 170 employees, revenues of probably about $100 million. And we've got, depending how you measure it, 3 to 11 man team, more or less full time dedicated on this space. So, you know, if there are any interesting fintech companies out there looking to raise lending capital or equity capital, we would love to hear from you. And similarly, if, you know, if there are any investors out there, IFAs, family offices, venture capital firms, private equity firms that are interested in this space and, you know, interested to, you know, how to safely allocate capital in a profitable way, then again, we'd love to connect. Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, we are very much focused at the moment in terms of creating this kind of peer-to-peer aggregator solution, lendingwell.com. And we're, you know, in active capital raising mode and actively building relationships with IFAs and so forth to make that a reality.
And what type of role do you play or what service do you offer? And we mentioned P2P GI up front, which is a very well-known one, and you're mentioning the lending world you're working on at the moment. You know, if I or one of the listeners am some kind of P2P space fintechie, what would you do for me for a fee?
So if you're a fintech company seeking capital, we would find capital for you and charge you a fee for doing that. We can also provide advisory services, so we can guide and incubate your business, provide advice, so we can introduce you to business partners. And if you're an investor, you know, in reverse, we can help you kind of filter through the different opportunities that you're trying to assess and help you make the right decisions.
Good. Okay, well, that's quite a nice sort of note to end on, because that's the kind of liquidity that grown-up markets need. You know, having been around the scene for some time, Liberum's name consistently crops up as being sort of very blue chip in this space, much more focused than going to one of the existing players. And with people such as yourself who've got a deep background in finance and banking in the first place and have been focusing on this space for some time and have been very successful in doing the sort of largest investment trust in the world, I'd really suggest that any listeners or any listeners' firms that are into what you're talking about, need the kind of service, check you guys out. And in terms of P2P, time has gone very quickly, and we haven't sat here and said, oh, well, I think it's terrible what I did at Lending Club. But on the other hand, it's a very good business, and the share price was high, and now it's low, and maybe it's going to go.
We can do that now,
we can do that now, yeah. We'll turn the microphones off and bore ourselves silly. So thanks for that, Cormac, and I wish you and Librium every success in the future.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with a tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.